Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Heart health is a major medical concern in this country and others. It's this nation's leading killer. Although significant medical advances in recent years have contributed to better diagnosis, treatment, and prolonged life, there is still much to learn. Recent research has offered new insight into medication, diet, and even surgical techniques. I'm Don Marsh, happy to have you with us, and also to welcome Dr. Michael Lim, Slough Care cardiologist and director of cardiology at St. Louis University. We'll be talking about ways to maintain and improve your heart health. Doctor, nice to have you with us again. Thanks for coming.
It's a pleasure. Good afternoon.
I'd like to talk about something that's been getting a reasonable amount of attention recently, and there was even a small piece in today's Post-Dispatch, and that concerns what has been called healthy obesity. Everything we've been hearing for a long time is that obesity is not good for you, but some people seem to think that it's not that bad for you.
Well, I think my general take on that concept of healthy obesity is we're trying to be more positive these days and not necessarily everything being either good or bad. I think that the concepts of healthy obesity are the folks that are overweight but are trying. They exercise, they are active, they are eating well and trying to continue to eat well, and I think there's a lot of credibility to that concept. Their weight might be heavier than we would like ideally, but they're doing a lot of other things to try to make it less than what it is.
So if the various markers such as cholesterol and other things that you typically would look at with regard to heart disease, if they don't have that kind of a problem, they are just as healthy as the rest of us who are not obese?
Well, there's in some ways, yes. So let's sum it down into there are things that are in our control and there are things that are not. And some parts of obesity are genetically predetermined. And just because your weight and height ratio give you a concept of you fit obesity on a sort of a plus-minus scale doesn't necessarily always translate into you're going to have heart disease, you're going to have a heart attack, or something bad is going to happen to you. It's a higher risk concept, but you try to control everything you can. So that's why I focused on the eating right and the exercise and the things that are controllable for all of us.
In the best world, someone in your position would say, lose weight.
It would be, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to some of the other things that are being talked about much today, statins being one of them.
Yes.
Give us your take on where we are with regard to statins now. There seems to be, again, some controversy as to how good they are for us, how much we should be taking if we need them.
So the statin controversy sort of got reignited in the media and in the public because the cardiology societies released a new set of guidelines. The guidelines are basically a summary of evidence that we have to date that supports which patients should be treated with medication plus lifestyle modification to try to reduce their risk. There's always been a great amount of evidence to utilize cholesterol-lowering therapy in patients who have already had coronary artery disease or had a heart attack. So that, and that's a category we call secondary prevention. So we didn't prevent the first thing, but we really like to prevent it from happening again. And there's always been great evidence there. The new guidelines have brought into play a couple different categories, and those are people who haven't had their event yet, folks who are diabetic that don't have coronary artery disease but potentially are at higher risk for events over the next 10 years. Maybe they should have their cholesterol lowered with medicine and lifestyle. People who just have a higher 10-year risk, they should have their cholesterol lowered with lifestyle and medications before they have their first event. And these are new things and new guidelines. And that stirs on controversy of can we adequately really assess somebody's 10-year risk of a heart attack? Is that appropriate? Should everybody get a statin? What about other alternative medications? And there's a lot of different ways to skin that fish. But I think trying to open up the door and looking at it and trying to reduce this heart attack number is probably a good thing.
Is there any potential danger in overprescribing statins?
There's always a potential risk every time we consider a medication. And aspirin is a medicine. And even niacin is not a medication in general because you can get it over the counter, but it is potentially a medication that we utilize. Everything has a potential downside. And so you want to weigh the ups of what you potentially get out of a medicine versus the risks of side effects of any particular medication. And you want that balance to be way out of balance. You want the potential benefit to way outweigh the risks of being on any kind of treatment, no matter what.
You know, I asked that question because, again, we've been hearing, and I hate to say this, but you can't always trust the media's take on some of these things. But we've been hearing a lot with regard to statins in recent years that it's really a very positive medication for other things, too, that it has been, I should say, not a medication for other things, but it has other benefits for us.
Well, we've looked at that a little bit, and in some ways that's been disappointing. And so there was talk and there was great hope at one point in time that medication, the statin medications could prevent or slow Alzheimer's disease. And those studies didn't necessarily pan out. There may be some other things with respect to a connection of colon cancer, and that's unclear at the moment. And so you never know. Sometimes medications come out for a certain reason, and then it turns out that they have marked benefits for a totally different reason later down the road. So you always have to explore those things. I think the issue with respect to the statins and their ability to prevent that second heart attack, though, that's very, very powerful data. And the ability for statins as prescribed by the new guidelines to potentially prevent subsequent heart attacks, I think that's worth strong consideration.
I believe that there are a lot of people who are suspicious of big pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, in that they put a lot of pressure on the medical community to prescribe drugs such as those that we're talking about and others when they may not be needed. Is there a danger of over-prescribing?
So big pharma is big industry, and there's a lot of dollars behind it. And there's always skepticism and fear with respect to biases and who pays for what and how data was potentially manipulated. I'm not here to try to preach to anybody. I think that there's always a healthy balance between the overly skeptical of anything that was put forward by big pharma or big industry, you know, you can't trust it, versus the other way around where you just openly accept anything. So I'm more of a middle of the road kind of guy. I think you have to look at everything with a little bit of skepticism. But prevention of heart attacks and helping people live longer, I think that's been reproducible no matter who pays for it or what kind of medication it is with respect to cholesterol lowering in the statin category. So when things line up like that, I think that there's some sense to it.
You know, when you watch television at night, you're apt to see a great many commercials for various medications. And I'm wondering what kind of pressure this puts on people like yourself and people in the medical community, because patients are coming in, I saw this last night and I want some.
Well, fortunately, from a statin standpoint, almost all of them now are generic. And so there's only a couple name brand statins out there that are still under patent protection, and the other ones are generic, and you don't really see the advertisements for the generic medications. From a standpoint of all different medicines, I mean, the Viagra and the Cialis was probably the biggest example I could give you in the direct marketing that companies did to everybody watching TV and listening to radio and hearing those things. That had a tremendous impact. And I welcome the opportunity. I mean, it starts a discussion, and that discussion could potentially help somebody from a symptom standpoint, from a prevention of something bad happening, and helping them live longer. That's a great discussion.
Well, another discussion taking place at the current time, and it's not a new discussion actually, is concerns trans fats. And the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, is talking, I don't know if it's actually implemented a ban, but talking about the potential for a ban at least. Good idea?
So where they stand is they put it out there to ban trans fats. And this is the public notification period, and so anybody can comment on that, and so it's not final yet. The actuality is that big business, the food industry business, has decreased trans fats in our food sources tremendously over the past 10 or 15 years. And so our consumption of trans fats has gone way, way, way down.
Excuse me for just a second. Yeah. I think we should just advise members of the audience who don't know, trans fats being used as a preservative and to enhance taste and that sort of thing, and almost everything that we eat off the shelf.
Right. So the trans fats, if you want to go back, and that's a good thing, so thanks for reminding me. You know, it came back to the original formula of Crisco. The concept of making a trans fat allowed the fat to not be in a liquid form but be in a solid form. So it was easier to transport, it was easier to keep, it was easier to stay on the shelf, it was easier to utilize. And so it was an ease of use concept, and those have been around for a long time. But as we were just saying, over the past 10 or 15 years, that's gone further and further and further away. Now, other countries in Europe and around the world have banned trans fats and have had some success in showing that their rates of heart disease have gone down. The issue is that it's not just trans fats. And so the other end of the spectrum would be, is that enough? Not is it too much that the government should say we're banning trans fats, but is it really enough? Should we work on forcing the concept of getting rid of more fats, getting rid of saturated fats within our diets, potentially putting on more regulations? This does morph directly into a political discussion, and is going to completely rely on where your bend is from a political concept of how much government should play a role in what you eat and how companies make and sell their food. But trans fats and saturated fats, there's no doubt, translate into increased risk for coronary artery disease and increased risk for heart attacks.
They clog the arteries.
They do.
All right. Michael Lim is our guest. He's a Sloop Care cardiologist and director of cardiology at St. Louis University. We'll continue our conversation on heart disease, and we'd like to bring you into this discussion. If you have questions you'd like to ask Dr. Lim, feel free to do so. Our number is 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. Back with Dr. Lim in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Michael Lim, cardiologist at St. Louis University. We have a number of calls already, Doctor, and I have other things I want to get into, but before we get too far ahead of what the callers want to talk about, let's begin with them. And we'll begin with Mary calling from St. Louis. Mary, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to comment on your comment about the medical community being seduced by the pharmacology complex in our society. That is extremely, I'm so surprised at you for saying that. That is extremely immature. I'm sure the good physician next to you is not getting a financial kickback or prescribe something based on a sandwich he ate or a pen that he's writing with. He is making medical decisions, and he is prescribing tailored pharmaceutical drugs for your situation. If anybody is controlling or encouraging or seducing, it's the pharmaceutical companies and their advertisement on the TV. When a physician has a patient walk into their office and say, I saw on TV, I need this drug, or I saw on TV, these lawyers are suing for this drug, so I'm not going to take it, that makes the job of the healthcare professional incredibly more difficult than it needs to be. Now, just recently, there were two articles in the local paper. One, I think, was today, maybe yesterday, on the front page about our congressmen, representatives, legislatures, all of them, receiving kickbacks in terms of sports tickets. Now, the good congressman in D.C. decided years ago to cut all pharmaceutical seduction that's going on in the physicians' offices. Ha, ha, ha. There was no seduction ever going on.
All right. Mary, we have the point. We have other calls. Let me just say two things. I never used the word seduce. I asked if there was any pressure that is applied to them through these commercials. And I never mentioned the word kickback. So to begin with, you're really quite off the mark with your criticism of that. You're certainly welcome to your opinion, but I think you're wrong. Now, Doctor, you'd like to comment.
So I think that Mary's point is that we need to always look at things very critically. But to instantly assume that just because big money is involved with something or industry is involved with something that you can't get a good medical opinion for the best interest of the patient is true. And I support Mary's concept on that. I wish I could say that 100% of physicians and 100% of medical personnel actually followed that. I think it's very close to that. But there's a few examples that are out there that have shown us over time that we can potentially be influenced in the wrong way. And so it's always good to keep a critical eye on making sure we do exactly what Mary wants us to do, and that is make good medical decisions for our patients and guide them appropriately.
Just to be clear, were you under the impression that I was suggesting that you and yours are taking kickbacks from Big Pharma?
No, but I think that this is out there, and this is a hot-button issue. And from a physician standpoint, you know, there's a lot of things that I can point to where we at St. Louis University or our partners at Washington University have worked with the pharmacy industry, work with medical device industry to improve on healthcare. And this can be perceived two different ways. One is that we're getting all this money from industry, and that potentially is bad. Or the other way is, well, we're working on trying to improve health and improve patients' lives and move healthcare forward. And there's, I think, an equal number of people on both sides.
Okay, let's take another call. We have another Mary. This one calling from South County. Mary, go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about treating AFib with Coumadin, as it is now, as opposed to, I've read some articles about the presence of H. pylori in people with AFib and treating the H. pylori with antibiotics and then that helping treat the AFib. Is there any real connection with that, or is that one of those internet hoaxes?
Would you just explain what AFib is, doctor, before we continue?
Absolutely. So atrial fibrillation is the most common heart rhythm disorder that we encounter and that folks have. And it's a heart rhythm disorder where the top chambers of the heart, instead of beating in a normal synchronized fashion, say at 70 beats per minute, actually beat kind of out of control. Fibrillation is basically just like a very fast shaking. And that's not able to move blood in a coordinated fashion through the top chambers of the heart. It's kind of a nuisance disorder, and that is that atrial fibrillation itself does not pose a significant problem in that you have a heart attack or you potentially die from it. But it does have a significant complication, and that's why Mary is being prescribed with Coumadin or a blood thinner, because that complication is as the top chambers of the heart quiver, blood can sit and pool and form a clot. And if that clot leaves the heart and goes to the head, it causes a stroke, which is a catastrophic complication that we try to prevent. And so most folks with atrial fibrillation should be considered or be on blood thinning medication like Coumadin, and there's other newer ones available that are sometimes good alternatives. Now, H. pylori is a different story. And the H. pylori story is one that goes back about 15 or 20 years where there's procedures that are done now that aren't done anymore now that used to be done for peptic ulcer disease or ulcers in the stomach. We used to cut out half the stomach. We used to do all these complex operations to try to get rid of ulcers because ulcers were eroding through the stomach lining. And it turns out that this bug called H. pylori was a principal problem in folks who have ulcers. And if you treat the H. pylori, the ulcers kind of go away. You don't need surgery and that type of thing. So that was a major victory. The relationship between the two has not been completely proven. And so I'm not sure I would call it a hoax from the internet, but in the scientific world, we would call that a hypothesis that's not yet proven.
You mentioned a type of surgery. While we're on that subject, we're reading again a lot about various surgical techniques with regard to bypass surgery and valve replacement that certainly is a sharp departure from what most of us are used to over the recent years.
So techniques in heart care are changing, and they're changing rapidly. And The things that we've developed over the past 30 years are still very good, and those are mostly the surgical procedures, the open procedures, and there's a big role for those. But at the exact opposite end of the spectrum is a tremendous development of procedures that can be done by catheter without big incisions, without big recovery times, and we can potentially replace valves, do things for atrial fibrillation, do things for holes in the heart where we can treat those and do great things for patients without the actual operation. And so we have a full gamut to be able to talk about and discuss with our patients now that we didn't used to, and so that's exciting.
So in many cases, the idea of ripping open the chest, if you will. You didn't like that expression, sorry, but you know what I mean, making the incision from the top of the chest, the sternum, and opening it up.
The thing that we always have to worry about from a standpoint of degrading ripping open the chest too much is that there still is a role for that. Mm-hmm. And when we recommend that, we have to strongly recommend that because most of our internal biases, whether we're the patient or the doctor, is we don't want to do that. So minimally invasive or newer must be better. And there still is a role for the old traditional. It's less than it used to be, but there's still a role.
Right. Back to the phones. We'll bring in Jerry calling from O'Fallon. Jerry, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, doctor. About 8 years ago, I actually got rid of my physician I'd had for well over 20 years because he was on the statin bandwagon. My cholesterol at that time and continues to be about 220. No history of heart disease in my family whatsoever. Moderate exercise, not overweight, et cetera. In addition, a couple of years ago, I went through blood cancer. In fact, my platelets and red count will probably never be the same. And yet, I keep hearing, you know, this take a statin that's going to take care of everything, and I just myself don't see it as a reasonable, you know, any medicine is going to have some effect. My view is like, you know, what's the point? So I'd like your opinion on that.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jerry, for that. So a couple things I want to hit on, one is looking at total cholesterol is something that I think we really want to try to move people away from. Mm. And so the total cholesterol being above 200, I saw a patient in the office yesterday. Her total cholesterol was above 200, but more than half of it was the good cholesterol or the HDL. And so looking at the actual cholesterol panel, which shows us the HDL cholesterol, which is good cholesterol, and H stands for have it as high as we can get it, the LDL cholesterol, and the L stands for lousy, and you want it as low as you can possibly get it, especially if you have coronary artery disease, and the triglycerides, which I sort of call those as the ugly. If one's the good and one's the bad, then they have the ugly, right? So, you know, we want to look at those subfractions to try to look at things. But before we even do that, the new guidelines, Jerry, would suggest that if you don't have diabetes, your physician or myself should actually try to estimate your 10-year risk of coronary artery disease. And if it's not greater than 7.5% risk over the next 10 years, then you wouldn't be prescribed a statin therapy based on the guidelines that just came out this past month. But that is a new category. And before that, there wasn't any category from that standpoint of people who don't have coronary artery disease for primary prevention. That's not saying that there are some folks that have a very bad family history. And so their dad died in their 40s and their grandfather died when they're in their 40s and their mom's dad died when he was in their 40s. And you're looking at it and saying, well, you know, I exercise and I eat right and my LDL cholesterol is 130. Is that good enough? And the answer is, well, we don't know. Well, can I take one of those statins and it will it help? And the answer is, well, it might help. Will it hurt? Well, it might hurt if you don't tolerate the medication, but it might help because you're doing everything else right. And so this, Jerry, is an individual decision that should always be made. The patient or you always have to buy into being on a medication or wanting to do it, and the physician just guides you with respect to what the evidence is for the pro and what the potential evidence is for the con.
The number that he gives, 200, how is that? That's a combination of all the good, the bad, and the ugly?
Yeah, it's a combination of the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so we kind of focus on the LDL cholesterol as actually being the number that is more important in translating directly into heart attack risk.
Right. Back to the phones. A lot of good calls today. Madeline in St. Louis, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, Madeline, go ahead, please.
I was wondering if the guest could speak about how healthy sleep contributes to a healthy heart and vice versa.
Thanks for the call.
Okay, Madeline, what we know is a few different things. The body does need to rest. The body does need to sleep. It does need to relax. And folks who can't get or don't get a good night's sleep, they have a higher risk for heart attacks, and we know that. There are some reasons why people don't get good sleeps. Some of those are problems. One of them is obstructive sleep apnea, where during sleep, breathing stops for a period of time. And that puts an added strain on the entire body, including the heart. It does create a risk for having the heart pump get weaker over time. It does create a risk for an arrhythmia like the atrial fibrillation arrhythmia we talked about before. And so there is a connectivity that's there. The problem with any of these associations are that it's an association. It's not a one-to-one guarantee. And so, you know, what you want to try to do is you want to try to do the best thing for yourself that you can. You want to try to optimize your sleep habits, get your appropriate rest, and do everything else too. If you can't rest or you can't sleep well, look into it, get it figured out, make sure there's not something that's inhibiting you or stopping you from being able to get your adequate night's sleep.
How much sleep do we need?
I'm not sure that there's an actual number that will qualify for all of us. It gets bantied about, I think, in general, the average adult, probably about 7 to 8 hours of sleep. Mm-hmm. But this is full sleep. This isn't necessarily sleep with a TV on. This isn't sleeping 3 hours and then five more hours at a different time. That's probably 7 to 8 hours. And during that time, the heart beats much slower. The metabolic rate of the body goes way down, and everything sort of recharges. And this is a gross simplification of what happens during sleep. But as those things happen, the stress level and everything else just relaxes in the body. And that's good for more than just the heart. I think it's even more beneficial probably for the brain. And we know there's a powerful mind-heart connection. When the mind's not happy, the heart's not happy, and vice versa.
You're listening to Dr. Michael Lim, cardiologist at St. Louis University. More calls. Dotson in St. Louis, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. My question is about palm oil and coconut oil. We have always thought those oils contribute to high cholesterol, but lately there have been a barrage of information in the internet that concerning the health benefit of palm oil and coconut oil, even to lowering your blood sugar. Yeah, I wanted to ask the doctor if they have any information and any research about those.
So, Dawson, that's a great question, and I think this has a lot to do with are there safe oils that we can cook with and utilize? And I think the more common one that most of our listeners probably are thinking about is olive oil. And so there's a lot more out on the internet and published in scientific literature about the contribution of olive oil potentially to a heart healthier lifestyle, like in the Mediterranean diet. Coconut oil is one that I'm not as familiar with respect to its benefits from a heart standpoint or a sugar standpoint. But in general, the beneficial things versus the lack of beneficial things in oils have to do with the amount of saturated fat. And so you want to utilize oils that do not have saturated fat. And that's why the benefits of olive oil have been touted and the benefits of the Mediterranean diet have been touted is because the saturated fat is markedly lower or absent in those types of oils. There's a different opinion, and that is that, you know, the Mediterranean diet is good, But it's not the absolute diet we should be striving for, because the absolute diet we should be striving for is not to have oils within our foods and not to consume these things, because that's actually better. Now, it sort of depends, I think, on your own personal mindset of how much you can take on in changing your diet from what it is now, which is, does have oils and other things that are used for flavoring because we enjoy what our food tastes like, and how much we're able to get rid of that.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have oils naturally in some of the foods we eat, particularly fish.
We do. And so those oils are things that potentially are beneficial, and the fish that we talk about from those benefits are the omega-3 fatty acids, and the fish that live way down deep under the sea, the ones that need these fats to actually not freeze to death. And so the salmons and the deep sea low bottom feeding fishes are the ones that are rich in these oils, and we know that folks that principally eat fish. So we learn this from the Japanese. We learn this from other cultures that principally eat fish, and fish rich in these oils. They have almost non-existent heart disease in those populations. And so that's the association where we think that there's benefit across those links.
How do they compare, and maybe you don't know, it's almost an unfair question, how do they compare with the people on the Mediterranean diet, people of the Mediterranean who are eating that particular way?
Well, the folks who really are from the Mediterranean have not been overly influenced by Western culture, which continues to creep into Europe all the time. Their incidence of heart disease is very low as well, and that's why people started looking into, hey, well, what is it about the folks who live around the Mediterranean that translates into that? And they came up with a few different things. One was the olive oils. And two is the amount of fish they eat, because they live on the Mediterranean Sea and their diet is rich in seafood. Very similar to Japan, whose diet is rich in seafood. Again, those Japanese who are not overly corrupted, if we can use that word in quotations, by the Western world of pre-prepared foods and fast foods and that type of thing.
And yet we do hear, as the American influence makes its way into Asia, China in particular, there has definitely been an uptick in coronary problems.
The biggest populations of increase in coronary artery disease and heart attacks are in China and India. There are large populations there to start with, but Western foods and Western lifestyles have grown significantly in those two regions. And when we go to international meetings, there's not enough interventional cardiologists that can take care of coronary artery disease in China or India. There's tremendous problems.
There is a message there and a lesson there probably. Michael Lim is our guest, Dr. Michael Lim, from cardiologist, a slew care cardiologist from St. Louis University. Back to continue our conversation and to make you a big part of it at 382-8255. We'll be back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back to our conversation with Dr. Michael Lim, slew care cardiologist. Doctor, before we continue, I have something here that our production team has just brought in with regard to our first caller, Mary, and the influence of the pharmaceutical industry. I'll read that if you don't mind. Some listeners may remember reporting from June of this year by NPR and ProPublica. It was about how some top Medicare prescribers rake in speaking fees from drug companies. For example, 9 of the top 10 prescribers of Alzheimer's drug Exelon received money from the company that makes it. 8 of the top 10 for a Johnson & Johnson painkiller were paid speakers, as were 6 of the top 10 prescribers of the antidepressant made by Pfizer. And a survey published in the Archives of Internal Medicine in 2010 found that physicians with industry relationships said they were more likely to prescribe a brand-name drug when a generic was available. Plus, companies have paid billions of dollars to settle whistleblower cases, which allege that such fees are thinly veiled kickbacks. We'll post a link on that reporting on our website. I do that for you and for Mary and for the rest of our listeners. There is a fire there someplace because there's a lot of smoke.
There's a lot of smoke. I think as anything in life, we have to be responsible for what we do. There are opportunities to make money outside of taking care of patients when you're a physician. That does not necessarily have to translate into how that influences how you interact with your patients and what you recommend. But this has a lot to do with your own personal integrity. This is my own opinion. It's not going to be written anywhere. But your ethics and what you recommend as a physician and your relationship that you have with your patients should be beyond reproach. And if that's not the most important thing to your physician, then I think these topics that we talk about, they start becoming greater. But if that is the most important thing to you, then I think that these other things probably are of very little influence.
And we should point out, as in any profession, there is the occasional bad apple that causes problems for all the rest.
Unfortunately,
that,
true.
That is true. Back to the phones. Sherry from Bethel, Missouri. Go ahead. You're on the air.
This is Sherry, and I am an earlier caller had said something about not being diabetic, gave a number for his cholesterol. This is off my last testing, is that my total cholesterol is 172, HDL is 78, the LDL is 84, and my triglycerides are 49. I've been a diabetic for 35 years. I exercise regularly, and I am not overweight. So I was recommended to go on statins, and I declined to do that because of the side effects I know they have. So I'm just curious as to why that whole notion of diabetes just puts such a spin on that.
Well, Sherry, thanks for that. And I think that that's a very important and timely question, because we talked about one of the new things with respect to the guidelines for cholesterol lowering, including folks like yourself with diabetes. And unfortunately, what we've learned is that diabetes is a major igniter of what we call atherosclerosis, which is the formation of the lipid cholesterol plaques within the arteries that supply blood to your heart. And it's a bad card when you pull it out of the deck and you say, whoa, you have diabetes. But it's not one that you can't get around. And so trying to get around that so you don't have to have your first heart attack is, I think, where the guidelines are basically pushing. And that is, if you're diabetic and you're between the ages of 40 to 75, the recommendation is, based on newer data that we have, that we provide what we would call moderate intensity cholesterol lowering therapy, which means lowering your LDL cholesterol somewhere about 30% to up to 50%. Most people can't do that with diet alone, and it's almost impossible to do with diet alone. And that's just because your risk for a heart attack is higher than mine, and I don't have the diabetes. I might actually have worse cholesterol numbers than you just put out there. And you could say yours don't necessarily seem that bad. But I would suggest to you that your risk for a heart attack by the data could be lower on a statin medication. However, that has to be individualized, and I've said this before and I'll repeat it. So if you and I are talking in the office, I could just inform you of what that risk reduction would be based on the medication, and we could talk about what the risk would be with the medication. We would then have to enter into a conversation with respect to whether you were interested or not. And you might not be, and my job is to make sure that you know the information. Your job is to understand the information, then you make the best decisions for yourself that you think are relevant. And that's how a physician and a patient should interact, in my book.
Let me throw another subject into the mix here, doctor, and that is testosterone and testosterone treatments. Again, we read that this could be a problem for people with heart disease, or potentially with heart disease.
Yeah, and I've gotten this question a lot, and the line that keeps going through my head when I get it is, this is deja vu all over again. Mm-hmm. And so a long time ago, we learned that our first guesses with respect to the reason why women don't have heart attacks when they're younger is because they have high levels of estrogen around, and estrogen is heart protective. And so we made an instant jump, and we said, well, then if we give women estrogen after menopause, then that's still heart protective. And then when those studies came out, and we said, whoa, not necessarily true. And we've totally changed the way we deal with women and menopause and hormone replacement. This idea that replacing testosterone with a synthetic testosterone strikes me as the exact same concept of replacing estrogen with synthetic estrogen. It's not necessarily an exact replacement. I think that there's potential benefits, but it's not a one-to-one thing, and it's not sort of a thing where everybody should be on it just because their testosterone is low.
Speaking of women, last time we talked, and it's been the case for some years now, that more and more women are suffering from heart disease. And this is, I think, the leading killer of women, if I'm not mistaken, or very close to it at this time.
Well, no, it actually is the leading killer of women.
What's going on?
The issue is that women's heart disease is very different from men's. We as physicians haven't done a very good job of getting up to speed on this over the years. Over the last 50 years, because we started learning about heart disease and heart attacks and all those types of things, and we studied men because the women weren't having these. And it turns out that women don't have these events in coronary artery disease or heart attacks until their 60s and 70s. And now that they're living longer, they're having more. And so it's a very different process. And what's similar between men and women is that coronary artery disease doesn't happen overnight. It's a process that happens over years and years and years and years. And years and years means not just five. It means 15, 20, 25. And it's a process that's not just singular related. You can't just say, well, I don't smoke, I don't have that problem. Smoking is related to it. Blood pressure control is related to it for those people who have hypertension. The diabetes we just talked about is related to it. Activity or lack thereof is related to it. We can't control our genes, but these are related to it. Other exposures to other chemicals, other toxins, other things. There's a whole wide array of things that play into the concept of how rapidly we develop blockages within our arteries. Women develop them when they're older. They present atypically, meaning they don't necessarily look like Fred Sanford grabbing his chest saying, Elizabeth, I'm coming to see you. They get short of breath. They get tired. These are very nondescript symptoms, so they don't necessarily seek attention very rapidly. And I'll just suggest that even though it's a big event, if a 7-year-old lady, especially if it's your mom, has a heart attack, it's much different phenomenon than a 29-year-old mother of two having breast cancer. And so the focus is on the 29-year-old mother of two, because really that seems like a big shame, because there's no reason why 29-year-old people should have to be afflicted with that, and there's no reason why kids should have to grow up without their mothers. And so we gravitate toward those. And that's where the focus goes.
I think there's been a temptation to think that women are experiencing more heart problems today because of their behavioral change, in the sense there are more women in the workforce, there's a greater degree of stress, and that's a contributing factor.
I can't discount that. Yeah. I'm not sure we have the full effect of that, if that's true, because the women in the workplace, they're not quite 70 yet. So if your hypothesis is true, we're going to see a big increase in that number, which would be going the wrong direction that we're trying to go.
Yeah. And the fact that it presents differently is really important, too, because some people might discount it as being something less serious than what's actually going on.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're approaching the holiday season and also the last couple of minutes of this program. I'll go back to the phones as time allows. But I wanted to talk to you about the holidays and things we should be careful about. We talked about stress, and, you know, people tend to get very, very busy over the holidays. They tend to eat and drink. What advice do you have for people as we approach this time of year?
I think that the advice that I would give would be to let's take a couple minutes and think about it. We didn't get the opportunity to talk about this before Thanksgiving, which is really the major eating holiday in our society. But we tend to celebrate with food. And there are some folks who already are burdened by some of these things, like being diabetic and having high blood pressure and what have you. They can't necessarily afford that big of a holiday with respect to completely getting off their diet or hurting themselves. And so doing things right and still being able to enjoy yourself is important. The stress of the holidays is real, and trying not to subject yourself to as much stress just because it's something you have to do. Trying to find mental relaxation breaks, trying to work on things so that you do give yourself a break, trying to divide out the task with respect to what absolutely has to be done and what would be a luxury. And if I get to it, I get to it. But if I don't, well, I gave it my best shot. There's always two different ways to look at all this. And the weather that we're going to experience, I think, later today is very stressful. Stress is provocative across all society, and so dealing with stress and trying to control it, I think, is beneficial.
Well, a lot of people will deal with the stress with maybe one too many drinks, alcohol.
That's a common concept. We also celebrate with alcohol in this society as well as food. Drinking and alcohol is not a substitute for good mental relaxation and stress reduction. It's not the same.
In the time that we have left, I wanted to talk about oral health and its association with heart disease.
So what we know is that if you brush your teeth, you take good care of your gums, you take good care of your mouth, that you have a lower incidence of having heart attacks. And people can say, whoa, I don't know if I understand that. There is a concept of an amount of inflammation that occurs within the body, and that inflammation could be the thing that actually keeps us from either not having a heart attack versus having one. Because it's probably too much to ask for all of us to prevent or come up with a concept where zero blockages occur within the blood vessels. But if you have blockages, you keep them to a low enough level and you don't ever allow those to rupture or break open, then you'll never have a heart attack. And so the inflammation is the thing that really kicks off and potentially causes those plaques to rupture and cause the heart attack. Keeping good care of your mouth and your gums decreases inflammation, makes it less likely you have a heart attack.
Well, I've always heard that inflammation is a problem, but thank you for explaining exactly what's going on in the body. I wish we had more time, Dr. Michael Lim, a cardiologist at SLU, St. Louis University, and SLU Care. Fascinating discussion. Thank you. I'm sure that many of the people who have called are very grateful for the information you've imparted today.
My pleasure. Enjoy the holidays.
You too, and thanks so much for coming in. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with folklorist John Aldani about his book on St. Louis Christmas traditions, with Broadway star and St. Louis native Sarah Bolt about her participation in a holiday concert, and with the director and co-writer of a theatrical adaptation of the C.S. Lewis novel, The Screwtape Letters. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at the fourth in a series of reports in the For Sake of All study examining the health of African Americans in the St. Louis area. This one focuses on the effects of segregation. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Jeremy Bailey, Kristen Torres, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.